I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So we run through the questions, and then if there's anything interesting, we might just pick up along the way. So you're happy.
Yep.
So obviously, ignoring the camera, your eyeline is to me.
Okay.
Do you think, in hindsight, maybe the help for nursing homes came a little too late?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of good look backs and personal reflections of what could have been done differently. Nursing homes are not built for managing a pandemic.
From the news team at Virgin Media Ireland, this is Room 631, Ireland's COVID crisis. I'm reporter Zara King. This six-part podcast series contains the unheard tapes from the Virgin Media News documentary team. These episodes come from hours of footage taken during the making of our documentary, Ireland Under Lockdown. Throughout the series, we'll hear the thoughts of key decision makers who sat inside the walls of Room 631 at the Department of Health, and the voices of the people whose lives were changed by those decisions as a global crisis unfolded in their homes.
It just seemed impossible to stop the trend of it happening and further spread into further nursing homes. I remember the night and the morning. It was morning time in terms of when he made his speech in the steps in the US. So on that night I was in the department with the minister and the tonist at the time, Simon Coveney. And we were there as NPHET were meeting in parallel. We were in a separate room and with senior officials as well and the Secretary General. And we were, you know, in discussions and dialogue with the Taoiseach, obviously, as he was in the States, through the senior officials at Taoiseachs. So that was quite an eerie time. It was very late in the night when we were in dialogue. We all went home for a couple of hours rest and then back early the following morning as the Taoiseach was making the announcements and preparing the planning for it. But we kind of knew in that room at that time, this is real, this is serious. And this is the responsibility I felt on my shoulders at that time. You know, I felt a lot of responsibility. You're part of quite a big decision here that's going to impact a lot of people, and have a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. So, you know, I did feel that.
And maybe you didn't even realise the time our lives would change forever after those decisions in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we kind of had a lens of we need to do this now and hopefully we'll be out of this, you know, in a period of time. And probably didn't have the lens to the extent of which we now know are in it. So, you know, it was a kind of, let's do this and let's get out the other side, you know, reduce the impact on the hospital system, and we can, you know, we come out the other side better. But nobody really knew how long that was going to take. We did know, certainly knew at that stage, the impact it can have on society, the impact it could obviously have on the economy, but the impact it would have on people's lives. But I suppose at that first phase, it was new to everybody and it was different and people wanted to protect themselves. People were fearful. Obviously, we moved into different phases later. Many people's memories are milestones around the first case in Ireland or the lockdown. But from our perspective, it was back into January when we were watching what was happening emerging from Wuhan. And I recall our first meeting of the National Crisis Management Team in the HSE. I convened, we made a call around on the Sunday, 26th. Of January, and we convened on the Monday 27th. And certainly at that time, what we were looking at, when you think about it, was 56 cases of deaths in Wuhan. But the first two cases had just been identified in Paris. And, you know, that was immediately alert to us. And they were transmissions, apparently, from travel to China. But, you know, even those two cases were an alert to us. This is actually, you know, transmitting. This is Europe now. Even though at very low levels. So that was kind of first alert to us. And, you know, then obviously as it moved on and you move into, as it transmitted into Italy and across Europe, you know, people quite scared. And from my perspective, very apprehensive. You know, I was only 7 months in the role. Now leading the HSA heading into a pandemic. So quite a scary period.
And people talk a lot about those images that we saw from Italy, you know, the mortuaries being built and sort of mass graves, and they were the real signs of it getting closer to home because they were in Europe.
Yeah, it was Europe. We could relate to it. People had been to those countries. Many people mightn't have been to China, but now they could relate to it very clearly. People had travelled. So it became very real very quickly, and the scenes that we were seeing of hospitals being overwhelmed, mortuaries being built, that's something that quite shocked and scared the nation, and also quite scared our workforce as well. It's something that, you know, might not always be understood, and they did go in at the front line literally, but they too were scared, and certainly from our perspective we were quite apprehensive about what was. We know our hospitals are under pressure on a good day. How do we cope with something like that? That was an immediate shock and alert to us about what we needed to do.
And presumably then there's meetings and conversations happening. What's the kind of tone of those conversations? Is it about emergency planning, putting things in place? What were the types of conversations that were happening?
Yeah, so literally from 27th of January was the first meeting of our crisis management team. And at that stage, we were looking at hospitals, our capacity, our ICU capacity, how do we increase it, ventilators, how many ventilators did we have in stock? We had about 900, how much more? But at that stage, even then, it was very hard to scale what we might need to scale up to. You know, we were looking at PPE and saying there's going to be a higher demand than PPE. We spend about 15 million euros a year. Maybe we might need to spend 100 million. If we were going to 100 million, and when you look at now, we spent over a billion on PPE. So the scale just increased very rapidly in terms of what we were going to need to do. But certainly the first phase, it was around hospital capacity, ICU, and even at that stage, mortuary, you know, that we would need to build a temporary mortuary. You know, and this was the immediate impacts and decisions we were making and mobilising for, you know, in January and into February. So they were quite big decisions and quite daunting decisions to be in the middle of.
Because I remember being in government buildings when the Liz Canavan was doing her daily update, and she'd mentioned the idea of temporary mortuary facilities being put in place, and I remember being shocked by that. That was a tough decision to have to make, and probably, you know, on a human level, you know, that's a difficult call to make.
Yeah, and I think we had to manage it on a sensitive basis because you didn't want to completely scare the nation, but we equally had to prepare for it. So that was our job, to prepare rather behind the scenes, so much behind the scenes about it, because it had to be organised. We knew what we were seeing. We knew the, you know, the capacity of our system, and that was something that had to be done quite quickly, and behind the scenes, but not scaring or shocking the public too early. But very real issues, very early.
And thankfully we never had to use them, which was a relief.
Thankfully, yeah. And look, I'm challenged quite rightly about some things that we've spent money on. Did we get benefit for it? Did we get best use of it? Whether it was private hospitals, whether it was City West. And that's quite okay. That's a public challenge. But I do also remind, you know, but we did have to invest in a mortuary. We didn't use it. It was the right thing to do. But thankfully we didn't have to do it. We didn't have to use it. And that's largely by the public actions.
In terms of things like you mentioned there, City West, PPE, private hospitals, these were all things that had to be put into place quite quickly. Can you talk us through some of the processes around those?
Yeah, so if you look at what was happening across the world, just even take PPE and say 15 million euros a year we would normally spend. Now we've spent a billion euros this year. And it was a worldwide chase on for PPE because China had stopped manufacturing, obviously across the impact of many of their cities. And it's one thing I'm quite proud of about Ireland punched well above its weight, and that was the impact of a whole of government approach to this, because we utilised the supports of the Department of Foreign Affairs, our ambassadors overseas in China, in Singapore, in South Korea, the Department of Business and Enterprise, IDA Ireland. We had contacts, and I always say we punched well above our weight, and we were securing PPE when other major world forces and countries weren't. And we had what I described at the time as kind of global piracy, modern day global piracy, where we had secured quite big orders, and other countries would come in, jurisdictions would bid probably five times what we had bid, and that was the scale of what we're dealing with. And just to give you one example, you know, a mask, which everybody's familiar with now, but a surgical mask, pre-COVID, we would have bought for about 37 cents. Very quickly, that was €11.40 on the market. And that's a scale the price. So we had to not just secure, we equally had to secure volume then, not beyond the HSE for our GPs and ultimately into nursing homes. So that just gives a scale of price and volume that we were dealing with on PPE and equally on ventilators, a worldwide chase for ventilators. And we needed them at speed because, you know, we judged we would need them for our ICUs and surge capacity. So there were big mobilizations that we had to do very early. But I do look back and be proud because there was a whole of government response, all supporting the HSE at that time.
And the support as well that we saw from the Defence Forces, for example, they got on board, and we remember the flights coming in from the Aer Lingus flights landing in Dublin and seeing the images of the trucks going out. That's quite a stark image. Like, it was normal to us at the time, but even now when you think about it and look back, I mean, it was really something.
Yeah, and I always remember the day I contacted the Chief of Staff of the Defence Forces and indeed the Commissioner, Drew Harris, and we met in government buildings, and we just, you know, again, I was quite overwhelmed by their support. They immediately, the Commissioner said, you can have our training centre in Templemore. You can have it as an emergency hospital if that's what you need. I'm going to graduate all of the guards who are in training. And I thought, that's fantastic. Immediately decision. Chief of Staff of Defence Forces, you tell me what you need, we'll mobilise. So the first call I did make to them was that we needed their support in setting up a contact tracing to centre. To mobilise. Within 24 hours he said, okay, I've 80 of our cadets in training, they're on the way to you. And I always remember that morning in Dr. Stevens looking out the window and seeing a fleet of army trucks arriving and the cadets marching into Dr. Stevens. And it was quite emotional to see the response so quickly, quite powerful to see, again, a state response around our health service.
And at that time, in those early stages, sort of in March, we'll say, what were you hearing from nurses and doctors on the front line? How were they coping and how were they feeling?
Yeah, again, quite apprehensive about it. People getting used to donning and doffing PPE in a very new way, in a regular way, than they would have had to do before. Whole new sets of ways of infection prevention and control that kind of make it a bit more inefficient, but had to be done all the time. But equally they were very apprehensive about what might come at them, how they would utilise their surge capacity. A decision was made at the time by NEFET, which was to, a recommendation by NEFET and agreed by government, which was to cease non-urgent care. And equally our clinicians would have been concerned about that, some of the impacts that may have on care. But at that point in time, it was the right decision at that point in time. We had to protect the capacity that we had for a potential surge. So, yeah, quite a level of apprehension across the whole system.
And was it difficult in terms of maintaining staffing levels? I know you've spoken about it over the last few months. There's been times where people will have been out on COVID leave or they're isolating for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at some of the first cases that we would have had to dealt with in hospital, where we would have lost a lot of our staff very quickly, you know, through an outbreak in a ward or in an ICU, and you could lose a whole shift immediately. And we did have to work with our trade unions in terms of what might be a pragmatic way about getting health staff back to work on a much quicker basis, but giving them the protections that they should have to our occupational health teams as well. So that was kind of, again, quite a new relationship with our trade unions, how they worked very closely with us to support us in that process. So, yeah, kind of a whole new way of our staff, our teams working with us. You know, I have to say, they did remain calm while anxious, you know, and they were probably calmer than many of us just about dealing with this and getting on with it. But many human stories about what they sacrificed when they walked out of hospital back to their families.
And we heard a lot of those. I mean, there was people sort of separated from loved ones and things during that time.
Yeah, I spoke to a lot of our staff and a lot of our teams. It's one thing I miss because I like being out and about in the services, but speaking to them, the sacrifice that they made that we don't always know about, we don't always hear about, not seeing their family for sustained periods of time, not seeing some of maybe their elder relatives, even at home for a longer period of time, their children. They were huge sacrifices behind the scenes. Kind of made me quite proud. And probably quite privileged of managing a health force of such commitment.
And we saw the tributes when people would come out, put candles in the window and would clap for healthcare workers. Do you think that was good for morale at that time?
I think it was good from a range of perspectives. I think it was good from the public because they really wanted to demonstrate their support for healthcare workers. it was absolutely fantastic for our staff, because even to this day, at that stage then, to this day now, our staff really value feedback. You know, you might think they get it all the times, and they do at the front line. But I often pass back, you know, a letter or a correspondence or a card I get, and it gets a really good reaction. So a nationwide reaction like that, you know, it's phenomenal. And I always remember a couple of instances where people sent me some stuff on Twitter where in South Dublin, I think it was Ballyroan, where a community had come together and they cut their lawn. And they cut the lawn in a kind of shared open space with the HSE kind of engraved in it, cut into it. We love HSE. And that for me was a very inspiring moment for people to, you could see the connection between the people and the health service like I'd never seen before.
We know that it was the nursing homes that were a place that really was hit worst by all of this. At what stage did you realise that the nursing homes was going to become such a significant part of the challenge?
And I often look back at this as well, because when we were all looking at the scenes emerging across Europe and the cases that were emerging, it was all about the hospitals, and that's what we were seeing happening. And it was at a later stage where the impact on nursing homes across Europe and indeed in Ireland emerged. So from that perspective, when I think there's a couple of things when I look back on that. Firstly, it was very hard to foresee the impact it had quite quickly on asymptomatic people in nursing homes and older care places. And an obvious learning, but an obvious thing when you look at it, nursing homes and congregated settings, as they are constructed, is not the best place for older people in a pandemic. And that's something as a state I think we have to look at for the future. But back then, high transmission levels, high impact very quickly, and mobilising around supporting private nursing homes and public nursing homes very quickly to see what we could do. And again, that was built in steps between PPE, some further supports, getting our public health teams in to support them. I found that quite a sad time when I see the impact of it. And you know, I found it quite difficult to deal with the impact that was having at that time.
It was very upsetting, I think, for a lot of us to see a lot of these cases unfold in the nursing homes.
Yeah, it was very upsetting because, you know, we've all relatives, we've all, you know, family who are in those settings or have been at some stage. And I think it became very real for the nation of the impact of it. And it was difficult because it just seemed impossible to stop the trend of it happening and further spread into further nursing homes and further deaths, unfortunately. And that is the time that, you know, if there's one point in the tour where I just felt, how do you get control of this? That was the point in time, very difficult time for us all, very difficult time for people who worked in those nursing homes, both private and public. And so, yeah, I found that a really difficult phase.
Do you think in hindsight maybe the help for nursing homes came a little too late?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of good look backs and personal reflections of what could have been done differently. I do mean it. I think, you know, nursing homes are not built for managing a pandemic. That's kind of one big learning. Second big learning is just the transmission levels. And our own GPs, I've spoken to them, who went into nursing homes and looked, you know, assessed people who are quite well, you know, no symptoms whatsoever. And then in a very short space of time contracted it. In a very short space of time, unfortunately, died. So, you know, it was a difficult one to protect and get around and support very quickly. So in terms of the learnings from her, in terms of the, was it speed, was it time? You know, there's certainly, we have to all say, we would do it all very differently again, and we are doing it very differently again this time.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The impact it had, we've spoken to different people through this, for example, on mental health was a really big one, because there were people, I suppose, who had never experienced any issues with their mental health, who all of a sudden were feeling things they'd never felt before. Was that something that you were very conscious of and mindful of when you were making a lot of the decisions?
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's something I'm personally quite close to. I would have supported a task force previously before I joined HSE, government task force around young mental health. And I understand that, and I know the impacts, and I've seen some of the impacts of my own family and mental health, so it's something I'm very close to. And decisions around restricted movements, and even now, I think there will be consequences of this for a long period of time from a mental health perspective we will have to deal with. And right now, today, we are seeing the impacts of people coming forward with anxiety levels, people coming forward with acute stress levels, and people coming forward with mental health issues, both younger age populations, all age and older age people. And that's one thing that does break my heart, you know, how we deal with this on a medium term and longer term basis, I think it's going to be with us. And it's just a kind of anathema to our society, how we like to mix, how we like to engage, and you break off all our natural chains of engagement, what's natural to us. I think there are impacts, and if there are impacts, we'll probably have to live with for quite a while.
And do you think the health service is equipped in terms of investment in mental health services to deal with the fallout from this pandemic going forward?
I think we're going to have to look at all our plans again. And it's too early to say post-COVID, but we're going to have to look at it for the next phase and into the future. So there's been many studies on, you know, a strategy, a vision for change for mental health. I think everything needs to be reassessed now, because the norms we would have looked at all that in the past have changed, and the impacts have changed in terms of people, and some of the consequences we don't know about just yet, in terms of mental health impacts. So I think we need to reassess everything in terms of priorities of our healthcare, priorities of our investment for the future. And so, yeah, I think that there's a very clear message that we're going to have to need to reassess priorities as we work through this and as we get the other side of it.
And another, I suppose, long aspect of COVID is the idea of this long COVID that we're hearing about, which is a relatively new term, and we're still sort of trying to figure out what long COVID really means. What's your understanding of long COVID, and what are you seeing in terms of the trends there?
Yeah, well, I speak a lot to our consultants, elite consultants, who would be dealing with this regularly. And one of the things they would be saying to me is our investment for the future, where we talk about ICU beds and capacity, and that's needed, and we will do that, and it has to be done. They equally talk about how you deal with the longer term respiratory impacts of COVID. That's just one aspect. We spoke about mental health, but respiratory as well. And the need to probably increase our resourcing around some of the longer term impacts of COVID. It's not always known just yet. People refer to the phrase of long COVID, and there's different views of what that will mean. And again, some of it we don't know, but certainly what our consultants are saying to us is we're going to have to resource in a new way for treating people over medium-term, long-term impacts of COVID.
In terms of the challenges then, as we began to reopen and normal health service started to resume, because a lot of people talk about the difference between now and earlier in the year. Earlier in the year, things were cancelled and hospitals were freeing up to just focus solely on COVID. Whereas in the second surge, whatever we want to call it, the healthcare workers, the frontliners are working on other stuff too, not just COVID. Like the hospitals are, a lot of them are at nearly full capacity.
Yeah, well, I think we're in a very different phase, as you say now, as we are working to restore all of our non-COVID services. We're very anxious. I mean, I've been very public about this from a HSE's perspective. Restrictions or stay at home or lockdowns, they have a very significant impact on the health service. So apart from society, apart from the economy, on our health service, they have a very significant impact. So we're seeing people, some people coming through for care now, and they should have come through much earlier, probably out of fear to go to our hospitals. And what our consultants are saying to us is the longer people leave it, the more complex the intervention is needed in terms of their care, and the higher the risk, and equally less better outcomes emerging from it. So that is a constant concern I have in the health service. As we see our hospitals right now, the numbers of COVID cases would be obviously lower than we had at the peak. So just over 300 today as we speak. But the impact of those numbers are very significant, because one positive case can ultimately lead in a ward being shut down. So it's a very significant impact. But we're very anxious. Our emergency departments are seeing much more reduced numbers than they were this time last year. So I'm quite anxious that we get people to come forward for the care where they need it. And that's still an important message for everybody.
I heard we were speaking to a consultant about waiting times and waiting lists recently, and they were just saying that, you know, waiting lists really, because of capacity and everything, have almost sort of doubled, in a sense that because logistically you can only have so many people in a waiting room coming in for different processes and procedures. Is that just an inevitability that we have to face now as we head into the future, into next year and the year after, that if you're on a waiting list, you will be waiting for some time?
Yeah, I think our waiting list has significantly increased because of the impact of those few months where we just didn't have elective care happening. And it'll be very difficult to catch up on all of that. So what we have to do now is prioritise those, obviously the most urgent care. So things like cancer and rapid access clinics, ensuring that people come forward. They were always open, but we did see reduced levels of people coming forward. Would be a priority, obviously cardio services, oncology, cancer, as I said, and others where we have to prioritise. So that is one. So for the future, looking forward, our health services are now managing dual services, I would call it. So protecting people against contracting COVID, and equally having pathways that protect people who come forward with COVID. So it's a very dual system. And you're right, the likes of waiting rooms, you can't have the numbers of people before that we had in our waiting rooms. But we're still very anxious to say to the public, and still very important for us, that they do come forward, and also our cancer screening services. I mean, recently we've seen just over 10% of people coming forward for their scheduled called appointment for cancer, for cervical check. So that's really important for us, that people, you know, feel confident and comfortable to come to our services. We have infection prevention control measures, but it is more inefficient in a way, our hospital system, because we have to put those controls, social distancing, infection prevention control measures, and a dual pathway system. You know, thankfully, government have funded us significantly extra funds as we head into next year to manage that inefficiency that is built into all of those controls.
Looking back, was there anything this year that you would have done differently, or with the benefit of hindsight, is there anything you'd have changed?
Yeah, well, you know, I was on the record very early and very often by saying, you know, I guess I expected we would get 70% of our decisions right, and there'd probably be 30% of them we might get wrong or we'll have to learn from. And that's a good ratio for anybody. But there's always an expectation in public service you'll get 100% of your decisions right all of the time. But I wanted to be very clear, and I said this to ministers, governments, RoCTIS members, party opposition leaders, our own board, that we were going to have to make decisions, and we're going to have to quickly make decisions all of the time. Michael Ryan talks about it in WHO, you've got to make quick decisions and make them regular. So, you know, I'm proud that we've made decisions quickly. The ones that I would do differently again, certainly our utilisation, how we would utilise private hospitals, nursing homes in terms of responsiveness, or how we work collectively around protection of nursing homes. Obvious two big lessons that we will do differently and have done differently for this phase.
What was the toughest or the most difficult day you've had through all of this since it began?
Yeah, at a personal level, or professional level in my job, what I have found really difficult was talking to relatives, spouses, partners who'd lost healthcare staff. I found that really impactful, just talking to them, you know, as their relative had passed away. From obviously just the tragedy of it alone, what they sacrificed for going into work, the commitment they gave to the Irish health system, to the public, their family not being able to grieve properly, their colleagues, their friends. So on a personal level, I found that definitely the toughest thing I've had to do in my career. It was really impactful for me. And it still does, as I thankfully having to do less of it. But any one of those calls, they really set me back quite a lot.
what's it like to be in charge of a health service in a global pandemic?
Yeah, it's a great privilege. I've said this to people quite a lot. Many people say it to myself, but particularly our frontline workers, you know, it must be challenging, it must be difficult. But actually, it doesn't feel like that for me. It feels quite a privilege to be getting up in the morning, to be part of a system that's so key for Ireland right now, to be right at the centre of it, to influence in some of the decisions. But more importantly, to be making an impact on people's lives, to be trying to protect people's lives, and with the public support and with our own support, we've done that. You know, so from a professional level, that's what it feels like for me. You know, at a personal level, it's been quite a strain. You know, since the 27th of January, more than anybody else, I'd say I've had, you know, maybe 4 days off. At this stage, but you know, that's you just have to kind of get your energy from different places, and I obviously get it from my family. And you know, that gives me a boost of energy. But on a personal level, it's been quite a challenging time. You know, you get days where you're just purely exhausted, but you get your energy down from seeing some things working.
Yeah, I know your grandchild is living overseas. You've been very public about missing out on a lot of those milestones. It's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. I mean, my own wife has a chronic illness, so from our perspective, that was at a personal level, was my first concern to protect her. During this phase, so you know, she would be at one of the high risk categories. That was our first one, and then obviously missing family. As you say, we had a granddaughter born October of last year. Thankfully, we got to see her twice in November and December in Austin, Texas. But we would have had many plans this year. But FaceTime is a savior, and you know, I said it publicly: a 15-minute FaceTime call gives me an energy for 2 weeks with our granddaughter. So you know, it's good. It's a new way, I think, of people communicating. It doesn't beat. Especially your first year of a grandchild, but look, we're safe and we count our blessings every day.
Do you think we're forever changed as people by this, Paul?
I hope not. I think it's having an impact on society, no doubt. We spoke about mental health and apprehension levels of communities, but how we engage, how we connect, all that we value as a society, how we live our lives, we're very different than many other European countries. We like people and we like to engage with our families and friends, and that feels kind of cut off. So I don't expect we change. I think it's in our DNA in terms of what we value as a society. But it is very different right now, and it doesn't feel the same. And why would it? But I think we'll hold true to what we are. Irish population over many hundreds of years have been through quite a lot of trauma. And we've held what is good about our values, about how we support each other, how we value each other. And I think we'll hold true on that.
What would you say to people? I suppose maybe we're heading into Christmas now. They're a little bit fed up with all of this. It's been a tough year for them.
I really hope people can have a good Christmas. We all need it. We all deserve it. People deserve it. And I think the sacrifices the Irish public have made, I really feel for people who've lost their job. I really feel people who are concerned about their mortgages. I really feel for businesses who are unsure whether they'll ever open again, and some of them probably won't. So I think as a nation, we owe it to them to have a good Christmas. And we have to do everything in our power to make that happen. Obviously, it'll be different. But you know, we're a good nation for celebration of Christmas. It brings out the best in us and our values. And I hope we don't compromise that.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.